WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Doris Lessing has a special place in the hearts of many women who came of age in the 60s and 70s. Lessing's novels, like The Golden Notebook and the Martha Quest series, had what many women then were starving for but rarely found, stories about contemporary, independent, unconventional women. Lessing later turned to science fiction. She's lived in England since 1949, but like her character Martha Quest, she grew up in Africa. She was born in Persia and moved to southern Rhodesia when she was 5. She later opposed the white minority government, and when she left, she was banned from returning for 25 years. When Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, she was able to go back. Her new memoir, African Laughter, is about the 4 trips to Zimbabwe she made in the 80s and 90s. These trips led her to think about the past. When she was born, her father worked for a bank in Persia. She told me why her family moved to Africa to start a farm.
My father's family were all farmers. Before him, they were all farmers. They were farmed in Norfolk, Essex, and Suffolk. And his father, for some mysterious reason, I don't know why, became a bank clerk and spent all his time playing the village, the organ in the village church. My father spent his childhood with the farmer's sons. So when he got a chance to farm, he took it. That's one reason. The other reason is that, like many of the soldiers of that old war, that's the First World War, they couldn't stand England anymore. They regarded themselves as having been betrayed because, I mean, people would laugh now at their innocence, but those soldiers believed that this was a war-to-end war. And they were very idealistic in a way that nobody was in the Second World War or could be now. So even now you can meet people, old men from Germany, France, very old men who will tell you the same. They believe that they fought the war in the trenches to end war. Well, my father just thought that England was corrupt and had broken all its promises and didn't want to live there again. So he went out to southern Rhodesia.
Did he get what he wanted?
He didn't get what he said he wanted. What he wanted to be, he was all set to be a successful farmer and grow maize and become rich and all that. But what he actually did was to spend his life in the bush, I think rather happily, watching nature at it, you know, and watching stars and the ants and the bushfires. I think he was rather happy.
Your father employed 40 to 60 Africans on the farm, depending on the season. What was your relationship with the workers?
Well, it was the relationship of a white minority with a very suppressed black population. You know, I was the, like all the whites, we were behaved as if we owned the place, which we did for a bit.
In one of your short stories, you wrote about a girl growing up on a farm in Africa. And she says the black people on the farm were as remote as the trees and the rocks. It was impossible to think of the black people who worked about the house as friends, for if she talked to one of them, her mother would come running anxiously. Come away, you mustn't talk to natives.
That's right. That was true in southern Rhodesia. It was not true in South Africa, interestingly enough, because you meet South Africans brought up. They will always talk about their black nanny, you know, with immense affection. But this didn't happen in southern Rhodesia. There was I think it's probably because the physical conquest of the place, which is a very brutal one, was quite recent. It was only in the 1890s.
When did you become uncomfortable with that relationship?
Oh, much later. You know, people that like to romanticize this a bit, you know. They say, oh, how were you able to see the truth when other people did not? Well, I did not see the truth. Being uncomfortable about what you see, which I certainly was, is one thing, but knowing what was wrong, you have to have something to compare it with, and I had nothing to compare it with. I didn't have anything. No one I ever met had a different perspective. So it wasn't until I had grown up a bit and I met other people that I was able to see the system for what it was. That's when I became an antagonist of the system.
And what did you do to show your...
There were a group of people who were, most of them, communists, or called themselves communists, which was very common in those days, you know, because looking back, of course, they weren't communists at all. And we ran an inordinate number of societies. Most of them were informational, like left clubs and study groups, and you name it, we ran it. And in fact, we did have quite a useful effect while it lasted, not least on ourselves, because, you know, if you're providing everybody else in sight with books and libraries and pamphlets, you learn quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. What was your awakening to women's status in society? And I ask you that because so many women think of your novel, A Golden Notebook, as being the first feminist novel they ever read.
I know they do, but I never wrote it as a feminist novel.
I know you've said that.
See, what I was writing was simply out of my own experience, which I think has got a valuable lesson. I do not think writers ought ever to sit down and think they must write about some cause or theme or something.
Mm-hmm.
If they write about their own experiences, something true is going to emerge, whether they mean it or not. About the status of women, my mother, in her time, was a feminist. You know, she fought her father to go off and be a nurse. Now, this is by no means a simple fight, because he was in advance of his time and he wanted her to go to university. You know, it wasn't very common for girls to go to university. She said, no, I'm going off to be a nurse. And he said, like a bad novel, if you do, never darken my doors again. And she went off, became a nurse, was extremely good at it and successful. And then he wanted to forgive her, and she didn't forgive him. This is a very sad story, in fact. I'm not saying she never spoke to him, but she didn't forgive him because she had such a hard time doing it on her own. And she had all kinds of feminist ideas, which for her time were quite advanced, so I was brought up with them.
My guest is Doris Lessing. She's written a new memoir called African Laughter. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Doris Lessing is my guest. You spent several years in a convent school, 5 years, I believe, and you write that it harmed you and that you're still learning how much harm. What was the damage that it did to you?
Well, it was first I was homesick to the extent of being physically ill and certainly emotionally ill. I was desperately, desperately miserable, and I think a lot of children are in boarding schools, and sometimes they forget it and sometimes they don't. They were also, most of the women who ran the place were German peasant women who were tragic figures, actually, because don't forget that was the time of the big slump, poverty in Europe. And it was traditional for at least one daughter of a peasant family, sometimes more, to go off and be nuns because at least they were fed. They then found themselves in Africa, these poor girls, aged 18 or 19 or something, stuck in a convent, doing the dirty work of the convent, with no hope of getting home in those days, desperately homesick and very lonely, and not necessarily there because of a vacation. They were there because they were helping their families out. Now I see them as very tragic figures. But they were ignorant women, very brutal because of their peasant background, and they knew nothing about children, shouldn't have been anywhere near children.
When you say they were brutal, did they beat you?
Yeah, they went in for beating. They also went in for some rather nasty verbal punishment of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church on its lowest levels is full of devils, hellfire, worms eating corpses, and we had our bellies full of this. Dished out, I'm sure that these girls thought that this was religion. I don't think it did any of us any good. I've swapped notes now with quite a few people who were at similar convents. And I think I hope it's not going on anywhere still.
Well, why did you first leave your country?
Well, I can't imagine a more tedious provincial suburban society than southern Rhodesia. They talked day and night about what was then called a colour bar. And people who had slightly different ideas, you know, ideas that aren't taken for granted anywhere else in the world, regarded as wild subversives. You just had to leave or you'd go crazy.
But when you left, you really missed the physical beauty of the country.
Oh, I'd miss that. Always. But you know, and I'm now missing something that hardly exists any longer. That is the point. It's been destroyed.
Right. It's been destroyed by development and now being even further destroyed by the drought.
Well, the drought is doing a very good job in destroying what's left. But, you know, a couple of good rainy seasons will put things back again. So all is not lost. I hope, you know, that as we talk, I'm wondering, what I wanted to do when I wrote this book was to try and create a kind of an impressionistic picture of Zimbabwe and people who perhaps know nothing whatsoever about it would then have some idea of what it was like and what it developed from, because that's what I used my family for, what the old days were like and the kind of society it was. It was a basis for this one. But I wonder if I succeeded, because it's so contradictory a place. You know, I could practically any statement I made about it, I could make the opposite statement, would be equally true. That's the trouble.
What? Where do you see yourself at now in your writing? You went through a series of years when you were writing a lot of science fiction. Your new book is nonfiction and very personal. You have a recent collection of short stories that just came out. So you're kind of, in the past few years, you've been writing in several different forms.
Yes.
So where do you see yourself heading now?
Well, I'm going to write volume one of my autobiography, and then I think I might... there's another novel that I have almost finished but hasn't gelled. Then I think I'll write volume six of the Cannabis and Argus series. That's the science fiction or space fiction. And then I'll see what happens, because I'm now 73, you know, and who knows what might happen next.
So you've decided it's time to write your autobiography?
Yeah.
And what part of it, part one.
Part one.
And what made you think it was time?
Oh, because if you don't, the biographers make up your life for you. You have to write it in self-defense. I'm not joking. It's true.
Doris Lessing's new memoir is called African Laughter. Her collection of short stories is called The Real Thing. That's Abdullah Ibrahim improvising on Ellington. This is Fresh Air.